This is another iRaw podcast.
We can argue that all sentient animals, because they are agents, because they are, once again, capable of acting voluntarily or intentionally, suffer harm when they find themselves in a position of inferiority where they risk at any moment that people, those in positions of authority, arbitrarily decide to intervene in their lives to prevent them from doing what they want with no consideration for their interests.
Welcome back to The Animal Turn. It's our penultimate episode, can you believe it? Well, not forever. There will be a second season, all things considered, fingers crossed. But it's the penultimate episode of season one, where we've been considering animals and the law, looking at a variety of concepts and what they mean. Today, I've been speaking to Valerie Giroux, who is a doctor in philosophy and an academic trained in law. Valerie is one of the two coordinators at the Centre for Research Ethics in Quebec, an adjunct professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Montreal, and she is a fellow at the Oxford Centre of Animal Ethics. Valerie does all sorts of research, primarily pertaining to animal ethics, rights, speciesism, and veganism. In 2017, she published two books unpacking these. Now, in this episode, Valerie goes into great detail and depth about liberty and some of the scholarship that's been done looking at liberty, the law, and animals. She gives long, extensive answers with quite a bit of name dropping. So I think that this episode would be really valuable for anyone who is entering the world of doing research on animals, ethics, and the law. You will note, however, that this episode is a bit more structured than what my episodes normally are, where I have open-ended conversations with thinkers about concepts and ideas. Valerie is not a native English speaker, and she asked if she could prepare a script for herself so that she could fully address what she wanted to say about liberty. We worked together on developing some of the questions, and again, while not as spontaneous as a usual episode, I think it came together really well. So Valerie provides us with a lot of ways of thinking about freedom. I didn't know that you could have negative and positive ways of thinking about freedom, and that the law was really a little bit more complex. Freedom is complex, like we learned last week. Autonomy is definitely complicated, and now we're learning that the idea of liberty is complicated too. So I hope you'll enjoy this episode. It's so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for this nice invitation. It's really an honor for me to participate to this series. I've enjoyed listening to the podcast with all your previous guests, and I've learned a lot. Claudia, if you would allow me, before we start, I'd like to apologize in advance to your listeners. I'm not comfortable enough in English to express myself spontaneously. So perhaps it is better to disclose that I've asked you to let me know in advance what questions you intended to ask me so I can prepare myself a little and hopefully avoid searching too much for my words. So if I sometimes give the impression that I'm reading my notes, well, it is because I am reading my notes.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here with me, and no need to apologize. As I said to you before we got started, it's great to have you, and it's been fun doing this in a slightly different way than normal. So I look forward to our chat. So perhaps we could get started. Why don't you tell me briefly a little bit about yourself and your academic background?
Well, I'm a lawyer by training. I completed a bachelor's degree in law and passed the Quebec bar exams before getting the license to practice law. At the time, I was involved in Amnesty International and was interested in humanitarian law. Except that very early on, I realized that many much more intelligent and very motivated students also wanted to study international law, the law of war, and humanitarian law, whereas no one was interested in animal law. So after passing the bar, instead of looking for a place to practice law, I decided to go back to school and do a master's degree in law on the 1997 Bill of Law C-17, a project to reform the animal cruelty offenses in the Canadian Criminal Code. It wasn't until my PhD that I reoriented myself toward philosophy. What happened is that in preparing my master's thesis, I realized that the issue I was interested in were fundamentally ethical issues. and that if I wanted to have a better understanding of what I was talking about, I couldn't avoid learning a bit more about normative and applied ethics. Mm-hmm. I also gradually came to understand how deep is the gap between animal law and animal rights, and how frustrating and perhaps even in vain it would be to try to get any significant improvements for animal by using the current laws without seriously challenging them first, without having a clear conception of how they should be. So I've decided to undertake a doctorate in moral philosophy with a thesis devoted to the extension of the most fundamental individual rights to all sentient beings.
Wow, that's impressive. We've had quite a few people of, you know, law and philosophy and ethics here. So it's incredibly exciting to talk to you about this today. Could you maybe tell me what led you to choose this subject in particular for your thesis?
Mm. The idea of the subject I was going to work on came to me quite naturally. I thought I would explore in greater depth the very reasoning that led me in my late teens to become a vegetarian first and then mm-hmm. vegan a few years later. At the time, I was shocked when I learned that there was virtually no qualitative difference between human beings and other animals. Some non-human animals are able to use sign language. Their range of emotion is wide. They can suffer just like you and me. They care for their young, et cetera, et cetera. I was shocked to realize all this because I was thinking about the immense difference in the ways in which we treat human beings on the one hand and other sentient beings on the other hand. I was thinking about the fact that we grant basic individual rights to all humans and that we consider slavery to be one of the worst atrocities while we cause pain, exploit, and legally kill an unimaginable number of non-human animals every year. I was distraught to realize that discrimination with such enormous consequences for non-human victims may in fact not be justified by a morally relevant difference between humans and other animals. I could hardly believe it, in fact. And I, as I embarked on my doctoral project, I was almost hoping to find a justification that would make us less blameworthy for this immense slaughter, a reason to think that it was morally acceptable to make such a distinction between us and other animals and to enslave the former for our own ends like we do. Unfortunately, as you probably expected, I found nothing of the sort.
Yeah, it's a really hard question because you kind of want to find the space to justify it's really. But could you maybe tell me? So you're speaking here about really big ideas, you know, speaking about blame and justification. But what exactly is your thesis on, or was your thesis on? Sorry.
In this work, I wonder whether it is morally legitimate to grant fundamental human rights exclusively to human beings. In answering this question, I relied on two main ideas. The first is the Aristotelian principle of equality, according to mm-hmm. which similar cases should be treated similarly. The second idea is the theory that rights, at least the most fundamental rights, have the function of protecting some of the interests of the individuals who hold them. Combining these two principles leads to another important principle of justice, the principle of equal consideration of similar interests. Individuals do not all have to be treated the same way in order to be treated fairly, but their interest, when they are comparable, must be protected by equal rights. And this allowed me to establish that all beings who share certain basic interests must enjoy equally the fundamental rights that serve to protect those interests.
With looking at these fundamental rights, what is the goal in unpacking these interests and rights pairs?
My work in my thesis consisted in examining these interests in turn in order to check whether they are the prerogative of humanity or whether they are shared by other individuals, in order to see whether it is just to reserve certain rights to human beings exclusively. I first considered the interest in not suffering, physically or psychologically. This led me to conclude that all beings capable of feeling pain, since pain is something unpleasant that individuals seek to avoid, have an a priori interest in escaping it and should, therefore, benefit from the right not to be tortured or the right to physical and psychological security. I then turned my attention to the interest in staying alive, which also seems to me to be shared by all sentient beings. Surprisingly, it is not so easy to see why even we humans have an interest in staying alive. There is this aporia raised by Epicurus that goes like this: death is nothing to us, since while we exist, our death is not. And when our death occurs, we do not exist anymore. If I am killed painlessly while I sleep, suppose I have no family or friends who would be saddened by my passing, who will suffer from it? After all, once I'm dead, I certainly can't regret having been killed. One of the best answers found in the literature on the subject is that provided by the theory of death, conceived as the deprivation of the good things in life. According to this theory, I am harmed if I'm killed because I'm deprived of everything positive that I could have had if I had stayed alive. At the very moment someone kills me, when I'm not yet dead but will imminently be, I am being harmed immensely by being robbed of my future. And from this approach, all sentient beings, because they can not only feel pain but also experience pleasures and desires, lose by dying the positive things that they could have experienced if they had going on living. Unless it is in their own best interest, as in cases of euthanasia perhaps, they too suffer enormous harm when their lives are taken away. And since all sentient animate animals have an interest in continuing to live, they deserve the same right not to be killed, or the right to life, as we do. Finally, I was interested in the third of the interests generally considered to be the most fundamental, the interest in being free. I wondered whether, in addition to deserving the right not to be mistreated and the right not to be killed, animals also had the right not to be held captive or enslaved. My research led me to conclude that if freedom is interpreted as the absence of external constraints, that is, the possibility of doing what one wants without being prevented from doing so by someone else unless it is justified, it seems that all beings capable of intentionality have an interest in being free. Since it is frustrating or painful for them, just as it is for us, to be stopped in their movements or initiatives. All such individuals, broadly speaking, this corresponds to all sentient beings, should be granted the fundamental right not to be held captive and not to be prevented by other agents from doing what they want, except in cases where a certain paternalism is perhaps justified. But I think it doesn't stop there. To that, I argue that it should be added that individuals who have an interest in not being interfered with in this way also have an interest in not risking being interfered with. That is, they have an interest in not finding themselves in a situation of domination where, even when no one actually prevents them from doing what they want, they are nevertheless subject to the arbitrary power of others to suddenly decide to do so. To be truly free, all agents, whether human or not, must not find themselves in a situation of subordination. They must be regarded as equals. I therefore conclude that in order to protect their interest in being free, we must grant sentient animals the same moral and legal status that we humans enjoy. Like us, all sentient beings must be considered as persons in due form. This work on the interests and rights led me to conclude that at least the most fundamental of our individual rights should be granted to all sentient beings. All those beings deserve the right to be protected from painful treatment, killing, and more generally, exploitation for our purposes. This is the only way, I believe, to respect the Aristotelian principle of equality and to treat similar interests of individuals in a truly similar way.
So I believe that you've published a book about this. Is that correct?
Yes, my thesis was published in French in 2017 with the title Contre l'exploitation animale, which can be translated as Against Animal Exploitation, as L'Âge d'Homme, a Swiss publisher.
And is there an English version of this book available?
Well, the entire book is not translated, but its last chapter on liberty was published in 2016 in the Journal of Animal Ethics under the title Animals Do Have an Interest in Liberty.
What luck, because that's what we're talking about today. So that brings us to the notion of liberty, the focus of this episode, of course. Could you tell me, is animal freedom something that is discussed in legal thoughts and scholarship?
It's true that in the literature, the first and foremost concern is the protection of animals from abuse. most authors recognize that animals, I mean, those who are sentient, normally have an interest in not feeling pain. Those who agree with the principle of equal consideration of similar interests will thus follow Peter Singer, one of the greatest figures in the animalist movement, who argues that the suffering experienced by non-human animals should be given as much importance as the comparable suffering of human beings. Per contrast, the question of the interest to live is much more controversial. Some authors, like Singer for that matter, will defend that an individual who lacks sufficient mental continuity, that is, who cannot have a conception of himself that is sustained over time and who has no preference for a relatively distant future, has less interest in staying alive than an individual with a continuous identity and desires for the future. Others, and I include myself in the latter group, think that in losing life, all sentient beings are harmed and that it is not necessary to have sophisticated cognitive abilities to have an interest in staying alive. But these two interests, however fundamental they may be, do not preclude the theoretical possibility of owning animals, giving them a lower moral and legal status, and keeping them as captive and exploiting them for our purposes. Indeed, it is theoretically possible to recognize that non-human animals should not be harmed or killed prematurely, but may continue to be regarded as mere resources from which we can obtain eggs, perhaps a wool, or some other useful services. These uses would not necessarily contravene the animal's interest in not suffering and in not being killed. These animals could therefore continue to be used as we wish, as long as we treat them kindly and refrain from killing them. In fact, a few authors have specifically addressed the interest of non-human animals in being free. The political philosopher Alasdair Cochrane is one such author. Cochrane argues that, unlike human beings capable of rational autonomy, non-human animals do not have an intrinsic interest in being free. He thinks that their interest in freedom is only instrumental. Instrumental in the sense that liberty is not per se valuable for them, but is valuable only to the extent that it helps to satisfy other more fundamental interests, such as the interest in not suffering and in not dying. Non-human animals have an interest in being free only because being kept captive typically involves frustration, boredom, or other painful treatments inflicted by the captor and often leads to premature death. And because he believes that the interest in freedom of non-human animal is only instrumental, Cochrane thinks that these animals can very well do without a right to freedom. What he tells us more precisely is that since freedom is not valuable in itself for animals, but only to the extent that it allows them to avoid pain and death, then it would be sufficient to grant them the rights to be protected from abuse and death. As opposed to neurotypical human beings, animals would not really need a right to freedom. Therefore, they may be used for our various purposes as long as their well-being and lives are protected by a right against painful treatment and a right against being killed.
So I understand that you do not agree with Cochrane, right? You want to say that non-human animals should not only have a right against torture and killing, but also, I guess, an active right to liberty.
Yes. In my work, even though I have tremendous admiration and appreciation for Cochrane's work, I've tried to show that he is wrong in distinguish as he does between the type of interest in being free that neurotypical human beings have on the one hand and the type of interest that other human beings and non-human animals have on the other hand. Cochrane argues that only those who are capable of determining, revising, and pursuing their own conception of the good can have an intrinsic interest in being free. And he points out that this is true regardless of one's preferred conception of freedom. That's where I disagree, or at least where I'm not totally convinced. In political philosophy, the three main conceptions of freedom are distinguished: positive freedom, negative freedom, and republican freedom. Positive freedom is defined as the ability to realize one's own nature, to self-determine or control one's own passions. This form of freedom is based on the rational autonomy of agents, that is the ability to choose for oneself, to be ultimately responsible for one's own desires and actions. I think that if we use this conception of freedom, if we think that freedom corresponds to the possibility of being the ultimate source of our desires and the real architect of our life's plans, it is reasonable to deny those who are incapable of rational autonomy the right to freedom, as it could not benefit them. But as I just said, positive freedom is not the only conception of freedom out there. Indeed, many authors, perhaps even most authors in political philosophy, prefer the so-called negative view. And according to the negative view, freedom is simply the ability to do what one wants without external constraints. According to this conception, one's will need not have been freely chosen in the metaphysically charged sense of the expression in order for one to be free. No matter where our desires come from, we are free when we can seek to satisfy them without being prevented from doing so by another agent. And once we adopt this negative conception of freedom, it seems to me that Cochrane's reasoning no longer holds that well. For if freedom is understood in this way, then it is hard to see why it should be possible and beneficial only to rationally autonomous agents. In fact, in the debates about the concept of freedom, proponents of negative freedom favor this conception precisely because it does not depend on the ability of agents to use their free will to self-determine. To argue, as Cochrane does, that one must nonetheless be able to determine, revise, and pursue one's own conception of the good or one's own wishes in order to benefit from negative liberty seems to me a little like trying to bring in through the back door a condition that had been rejected through the front door. I think it is much more consistent with the way the authors think about negative freedom to argue that all agents, because they are capable of intentional actions, because they are capable of having desires that they seek to satisfy, have an interest in being free, since being free in the negative sense of the word is precisely being able to act as one wishes, regardless of why one wants what one wants. It is not a freedom that ultimately serves another good. It is a freedom that, as such, benefits all agents. And since all sentient beings are agents, they all have an interest in being free in the negative sense of the term. So my impression is that we should consider that all agents have an intrinsic interest in being negatively free, unless we're prepared to say that no one, neither humans nor non-humans, can have such an interest, unless we're prepared to say that the interest in being negatively free is always instrumental, no matter who has that interest. It is valuable even to human beings only because it allows them not to experience the frustration of being prevented from doing what they want, or because it permits them to experience the pleasure and satisfaction of doing what they want. But that's not what Cochrane argues, and I don't think it would be much interest in defending that position. Accepting that negative freedom can only be an instrumental good would lead us to admit that the same can be said about life. In some sense, the value of being and staying alive is derived from the value of other goods, such as experiencing the nice things that life allows us to experience. Following this reasoning, we could perhaps defend that humans do not really need a right to life. Our interest in avoiding pain and in experiencing pleasure could suffice to get us rights that protect our lives as necessary means to satisfy that more fundamental interest. Above all, I have the impression that we cannot have it both ways. It cannot be said that beings capable of rational autonomy have an intrinsic interest in being negatively free, but that others do not. Because if we want to argue that negative liberty is good for non-humans only insofar as it serves other interests, that is the interest in not suffering and in not being killed, we have to recognize, I think, that we could hold that this liberty is also good for neurotypical human beings only insofar as it serves other interests, including perhaps the interest in exercising rational autonomy. All this to say that I believe it is best to recognize that all beings capable of agency, that is, all beings who have beliefs and preferences and who are animated by them, which is the case of all sentient beings, have an intrinsic interest in not being prevented from doing what they want. Because every being who wants certain things and is capable to behave to get those things has a prima facie interest in being allowed to do so.
So earlier on, while you were speaking, you mentioned the idea of a neo-republican conception of freedom. What is that?
I said earlier that many authors have abandoned the positive conception of freedom because they considered they considered it too metaphysically charged. Their fear was that such a conception may justify some forms of paternalism resembling authoritarianism or dictatorship. Indeed, based on such a conception of freedom, some individuals could claim to be more rational than others and therefore to know better than they do what would enable them to realize their true nature. They might then think that they are allowed to intervene in their lives to free them from their irrational desires by deciding for them what they should do. The positive conception of freedom might even oblige us to consider that a slave who managed to get rid of or to control his desires and passions is actually free. It is this counterintuitive implication of the possibility of free slaves that led some thinkers to criticize not only positive, but also negative freedom. These authors, inspired by the early 17th century English anti-monarchist thinkers, point out that opponents of the Stuart monarchy at the time denounced royal policies that gave the king such a discretionary and arbitrary power that his people, supposedly composed of free citizens, found themselves in a situation comparable to slavery. These dissidents argued back then that if they fall under the supreme authority of a monarch, then even subjects of a tolerant king who lets them do what they want and intervenes very little in their lives cannot be considered free. That is because they still live under the constant threat of having their lives turned upside down by their sovereign's decision to start limiting their actions. And it was, in their opinion, this precariousness in itself that undermined the political freedom of citizens. Following those dissident thinkers, contemporary authors such as Quentin Skinner or Philip Petit believe that freedom has even more to do with the absence of domination than with that of external constraints. According to them, being free means not falling under the domination of other people, not being subordinate to their wishes, and not being at the mercy of their moods and desires. In their view, it is not enough to be free from interference or to be able to do what one wants. To be truly free, one must be in a state of independence from the arbitrary power of others. And by arbitrary power, they mean the power to interfere as one pleases and with impunity. That is to say, in such a way that the agent who finds himself subject to this power has no recourse to obtain a conviction or reparation in the event of unjustified interference. Republican freedom thus depends on the structure of relations between individuals or groups rather than on the contingent results that structure allows.
Before I switch to the next question, I just want to make sure that I fully understand. So Republican freedom or concept of freedom is one that says that you cannot be free if there is someone who has the ability to dominate or like change your life randomly. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Whereas the other conception of freedom is that you could be free, so in your reference to free slaves, you could be free if you're just enabled to make your own decisions.
Yes, as a slave, I could be free theoretically if I'm lucky enough to have a master who let me do what I want, even though this master still hold the power of stopping to let me doing what I want. So in the time being where I'm still doing what I want, I am free negatively in a way, but I'm still not free from the neo-republican conception of liberty because that master keeps this power of interference on me.
Okay. So it's almost like it's a domineering power. And bringing this back to animals then, how would this neo-republican conception of liberty be applied to them?
In the spirit of the thinkers of neo-republican freedom understood as non-domination, I think that we can argue that all sentient animals, because they are agents, because they are, once again, capable of acting voluntarily or intentionally, suffer harm when they find themselves in a position of inferiority where they risk at any moment that people, those in positions of authority, arbitrarily decide to intervene in their lives to prevent them from doing what they want with no consideration for their interests. Being the property of an owner clearly amounts to being in a position of subordination. Being subject to the property regime provided for in our law contravenes the fundamental interest of sentient animals to be free in the Republican sense of the term. the idea is that since sentient non-human animals have a shared interest with us in having no one stopping them from doing what they want, they also have an interest in being in a situation where that primary interest is not threatened because of an inferior moral and legal status. Sentient non-human animals have an interest in not being interfered with, but they also have an interest in not risking interference. They have an interest in being free in the negative, but also in the Republican sense of the word. To be truly free, therefore, they must have an equal status and not be in a position of inferiority or domination. This is why I think that the interest of animals in being free requires that we give them the same status that human beings enjoy, the status of full persons.
Coming back to you here, where do you place yourself? So you've spoken now about a variety of thinkers. Where do you place yourself among other researchers who are interested in animal rights?
Peter Singer, for one, views our moral obligations to other animals from a utilitarian perspective and is therefore not very interested in their rights, the exception being the rights of the great apes, which he demands in concession to common rhetorics to advance struggles for more justice at the political level. In this respect, authors such as Tom Regan, Gary L. Francione, and Paola Cavalieri depart from Singer's approach. Regan believes that all animals who are subject of a life have equal inherent value and have an absolute right to respect, from which flows the prima facie right to be free from harm. Mm-hmm. Francione argues that as long as non-human animals are subject to the property regime, as long as they can be appropriated, we will never convince ourselves to placing as much value on their individual interest as we do on our own, and thus properly apply the principle of equal consideration of similar interests. The important thing, he says, is to renounce considering other sentient animals as things or goods and to give them the status of persons instead. Above all, he believes that other animals need a single right, that is the pre-legal right not to be considered as resources at our disposal. Cavalieri, and I agree with her, believes that the removal of animals from the legal category of property, which we can dispose of as we please, is not a right as such. Rather, it is a precondition for obtaining particular rights. Being a person is what makes an individual a subject of rights, the specific individual rights that must then be granted to beings capable of intentionality, would be first and foremost the most fundamental rights, that is the right to well-being, the right to life, and the right to freedom. Cavalieri is thus interested in the most fundamental negative rights, that is the rights that protect their holders against certain treatment. She explains her choice to limit her claims to rights based on non-interference by the fact that their extension to many animals would encounter fewer problems than the granting of positive rights to certain things, problems of conflicts of rights or allocation of resources, for example. Like Cavalieri, I have focused in my work on the most fundamental negative rights because they have a priority, because without them, all other rights seem insignificant. I recognize, however, that justice for other animals certainly requires much more than that. Sue Donaldson and Will Kimlicka, as I'm sure your listeners are well aware, they have proposed an original and extremely strong and convincing relational theory of positive animal rights. They suggest expanding the political categories of citizenship, permanent residence, and national sovereignty to include domesticated animals, liminal animals, and wild animals, respectively. I commend their work, which is generally received by animal ethicists as a huge breath of fresh air. I think that Sue and Will are absolutely right, and that non-human animals should, as they argue, be granted political rights. And it makes sense from a non-speciesist perspective to want to attribute those positive political rights using the same criteria we use to determine those of human beings.
So some scholars believe that animal studies scholars who advocate for individual rights are failing to see how individual rights are themselves part of a colonial world order. And in that fighting for individual rights for animals, animal studies scholars are just perpetuating what is a broken Western legal system. What do you think about that? Do you think that's the case?
The analysis of the discourses of Western social movements can certainly give rise to various interpretations. Nevertheless, it seems that intellectuals and activists, Republican, feminist, anti-racist, have defended their demands mainly in the name of fundamental rights. What most minority groups have historically demanded is equal legal status and the protection offered by legal rights for some of those left behind. Indeed, both suffragists or an abolitionist of human slavery have used the rhetoric of fundamental equal rights to advance their respective causes. Activists involved in several U.S. social justice movements have fought to ensure that more people are included in the community of equals and enjoy the key legal rights that are enforced by a coercive justice system. In France, same-sex couples who recently called for marriage for all have also done it without questioning the notion of individual rights. They have won their case and can finally marry just like heterosexual couples. Thus, in turn, people of different ethnic backgrounds or one gender or another or of various sexual orientations have been able to claim equality in law. While not all struggles for social progress are the same in every aspect, far from it, most had in common the goal of expanding the range of those who enjoy the protections afforded by legal rights, be they fundamental human rights or specific civil rights. It may well be that the best way to serve the interests of animals is actually to give up trying to get rights granted to them. The principles underlying the various liberation movements obviously do not escape critical scrutiny. Some authors argue that in order to hope for to liberate animals one day, major institutional changes will first have to be made, such as the overthrow of the capitalist system or a shift from a generally individualistic to a holistic approach. Others criticize liberalism or the very notion of rights, as you mentioned. But the fact remains that in a context where fundamental human rights are considered today as indispensable, almost sacrosanct, opposing discrimination based on species seems to require that we protect the similar interests of all animals with the same rights. To refuse to do so is not only to distinguish the animal liberation movement from other liberation movements and to violate the principle of equal treatment of similar interests, but also to force non-human animals to wait until we have agreed on and solved major political and philosophical issues before being legally treated as well as others. As important as these debates are, I would not want animals to pay that price. Let's broaden the mechanism that already exists so that they too can benefit from them. And let's continue to discuss whether we should replace the notion of individual rights for everyone, non-humans and humans alike, by something better for all.
So you tell us that animals must be given legal rights, and you add that only those who are considered persons in law can have rights. That said, you also maintain that it would not be enough to grant legal personhood to animals. You specify that the status we give non-human sentient beings must also be exactly the same status that is enjoyed by human beings. What do you mean by that?
As other of your guests explained before, our law system divides the world into persons on the one side and appropriable things or goods on the other side. Since animals are not in the category of persons, they fall into the category of property. They are subject to the property regime. They can be bought, sold, exchanged, destroyed. This is so even when the legislator paradoxically states that animals are not things, as the Quebec legislator did a few years ago, without taking them out of the regime that applies to things. In order to improve the legal situation of animals without preventing us from continuing to exploit them for our various purposes, some legal experts have suggested creating a new legal category specifically for them. David Favre, for example, has proposed creating a subcategory of property, which he calls living properties, and which would offer better protection to animals compared to other property. It would imply taking into account the fact that animals are alive and sentient. Other authors have proposed creating a third main category that would fall somewhere between persons and things, with much the same objective in mind. This would perhaps be a little bit more complicated because it would not be a matter of creating a subcategory within an already existing category, that of goods, but rather of renouncing the famous summa divisio that has applied since Roman law. A way to avoid this complication and still take animals out of the category of goods is to simply transfer them into the already existing legal category of persons. The concept of person is very equivocal. In philosophy, a person is an individual capable of self-awareness, rationally autonomous, morally responsible for her action. That is, she can deliberate morally before acting. She's capable of imagining the consequences of her action and of controlling her impulses according to moral norms. And in this particular sense, many humans are not persons. Young infants, cognitively disabled people, or senile individuals are not persons in this philosophical conception. In the sense commonly given to the term, the word person is synonymous with human beings. It means that all human beings, even those who are incapable of rational autonomy and moral deliberations, are persons. And this invites us to debate and ask if a human fetus, since it is human, is also a person or not. It also means that no one else than human beings are persons. Even if chimpanzees are self-aware, they are not persons. Animals, plants, artifacts, or fictitious entities do not have that status. In law now, it's something different again. A person is an individual or an entity that has rights and often obligations and can do some legal acts. As the legislator decided, she could have decided otherwise, every human being born alive and viable is a person. Additionally, some unconscious and even non-living entities are also persons. Companies, for example, are legal persons. Personhood is granted by law to individuals and entities to whom or to which rights and obligations are to be conferred. The reason is that the only way to have rights, the only way to be a subject of rights in the current legal system, as mentioned earlier, is to enjoy the status of person. That is certainly why many authors, among those who believe that rights should be granted to animals, are calling for a change in their legal status and for them to be given legal personhood. Again, this seems necessary in order to give them rights in due form and no longer simply impose on others, those who are themselves persons, obligation toward them. The problem is that authors who call for personhood to be given to animals usually do so without asking to extend to all sentient animals the very same status enjoyed by all human beings. The thing is that in law, there are already two subcategories within the more general category of persons. Natural person, all human beings and only them, and legal person, companies or governmental entities, for instance. What most legal scholars who would like to see animals better protected in law are asking for is the creation of a third subcategory within the more general category of person, a subcategory designed specifically for non-human animals, much as the subcategory of legal person is designed for non-sentient entities to which certain rights and obligations are sought to be conferred, but without assimilating them to human beings. The authors who defend this may be doing so for strategic reasons, so as not to put off those who find it offensive to consider putting non-human animals on an equal footing in law with human beings. They may also argue that since people do not seem prepared to give up eating meat, drinking milk, depriving themselves of the leather from the skin of animals, or experimenting scientifically on them, the recognition of such a status, precisely because it would allow these activities to continue, seems more acceptable socially and would still improve the fate of animals at least a little. I think this is a bad idea. I think that turning animals into a different and inferior type of persons risks reinforcing the idea that they are not our moral equals and that our obligations of justice toward them are far less than the obligations we have toward our fellow human beings. When we read the authors who argue for the creation of an animal personhood in this way, I think of Jean-Pierre Marguénot, who is well known in France in this regard, we realize that the whole argument is based on the desire to ensure that animals are not seen as our equals and that we can continue to exploit them for our human ends, even if a little less violently. Because the rights that must be attributed to sentient and non-human animals should protect them from certain treatment, like breeding them for food or subjecting them to scientific experiments, moving them into an intermediate legal category, wherever it is between the real persons and the things, would not meet our obligations of justice toward them, far from it. Since speciesism is not justifiable from a philosophical point of view, no legal category falling short from guaranteeing that their interests would be equally considered would suffice. I believe that we must aim at nothing less than for them to be considered in law as natural person and assume the immense changes that this would no doubt imply in our social organization.
So you are saying that humans and animals should have the same right to freedom in law and be considered our equal so as moral persons in our legal systems. Many would argue that humans currently do not have equal access to freedom, even if it's enshrined in the law. So what difference does it make if the law says that humans and animals have the equal right to liberty?
Having a right obviously does not mean that it will be adequately protected. We should denounce the fact that even in our societies where we pride ourselves on recognizing fundamental rights to all sentient beings, on recognizing gender equality and on having abolished slavery, we're still far from having got rid of sexism, racism, and the oppression of certain minorities and social classes. We still have a long way to go to achieve a just society where individual rights would be effectively protected. Having said that, I do not believe the solution to this problem is to give up the rights mechanism. Above all, I do not think we can seriously believe that there is no difference between the situation of an enslaved human who is the outright property of another and who has no rights over her own person on the one hand, and the situation of a worker, for example, whose employer abuses her on the other hand. The employee may be in a seriously unjust situation that is absolutely deplorable and must be prevented. But from there to saying that both situations are equally unfair, I think it would be grossly exaggerated. I would hesitate very much before daring to imply that it would not have been worse if we had never officially abolished the slave trade and the institution of human slavery. And it is first and foremost slavery that the right to freedom as non-domination protects against. If you have rights, it means at least that it is formally recognized that you can claim compensation or reparation in the event of a violation of those rights. It means not finding yourself in a situation where the only thing you can do is to politely ask for respect, beg, manipulate, or use violence to gain that respect. To have a right is to have an official recourse. And yes, there are plenty of problems with access to justice, discriminatory biases from those who provide it, etc., etc. But I think that despite all these serious problems, there is some value in the official recognition in positive law of the moral equality of all human beings. Sure, this is very far from being satisfactory, considering all the injustices that persist in practice. But to imagine a system where some individuals are officially considered as inferior being and where one can treat another as his property with impunity without any risk or even shame seems worse. Granting a right to freedom to non-human animals would in no way guarantee that they would be treated fairly in the future, but it would still be, I would dare to think, a very significant improvement of their situation. If only because it would no longer be possible to maintain and subsidize industries and institutions that raise animals and kill them, for example.
Okay, so you propose that we grant this legal status not only to great apes or animals that most resemble us, but to all sentient beings. You think that the main criteria for determining who should be part of the moral and legal community of equals and who should be excluded from it is sentience. Can you tell us a bit more about the reasons that led you to reject other criteria such as, I don't know, species, intelligence, the capacity for fulfillment?
In my research, I'm mainly interested in anti-speciesism. I'm concerned with what I take to be an unjust double standard. First, I note that there is now agreement about the fact that strictly biological characteristics, such as skin color, age, or body type, able or disabled, are not in and of themselves morally relevant and therefore cannot be used to shape the contours of the moral community. Most anthropocentrists recognize this and no longer merely invoke being a member of the species Homo sapiens to defend the idea that only human beings are worthy of moral consideration. Rather, they turn instead to other typically human characteristics such as cognitive complexity, mastery of symbolic language, or capacity for moral deliberation. Yet, these psychological characteristics are beyond the reach of some human beings to whom we attach equal inherent value and who, because of their vulnerability, we believe deserve even greater protection. To suggest a hierarchy of human beings on the basis of such characteristics would be indefensible. The only characteristic that all human beings have in common and that has moral relevance seems to be the capacity to be consciously affected by what happens to us and suffer from the way we are treated, the fact that we are sentient. We know very well, deep down, and if we are honest, that sophisticated cognitive abilities such as self-awareness, intelligence, or the ability to compose symphonies are not at all the basis of the moral worth of individuals. Mm. The fact that an individual may suffer a harm that she will consciously experience is enough. This is what makes her a subject, and this is what is morally relevant.
So you say that we cannot limit ourselves to including human beings in the community of equals, that we must broaden it to include all sentient beings. But why not go further? I've been in seminars and spaces where people say, oh, all this talk about animals, why don't you include plants as well? Isn't this just another arbitrary boundary justifying, discrimination?
This is a very good question, legitimately asked by environmental ethicists. Why stop there? Why not go one step further and recognize an intrinsic moral value to all living things or even ecosystems? To this question, I do not have a definitive answer, and I'm open to the possibility of a pluralism of values. Nevertheless, I must admit that my strongest intuitions are sentientist. Sentient beings necessarily have value because they attribute value to themselves. They have a subjective view of the world, they care about what happens to them, and therefore have so-called prudential interests, that is, interests related to their own well-being. Following the philosopher L.W. Sumner, I believe that if an organism or an entity devoid of sentience can be seen by others to have a certain value, this value will be of a perfectionist rather than a prudential nature. This value will be determined by someone other than the organism or the entity itself and will be determined according to an external fixed ideal. What is good for that organism or entity will correspond to what makes it, from the point of view of the conscious beings around it, a good specimen of its group. But morality is especially interested in prudential well-being. I am not sure that we can or should extend it to objective excellency. When it comes to the question of harming plants or ecosystems, I don't personally see how we can morally distinguish this from the idea of harming artifacts. Of course, we can have a very strong duty to protect them for the sake of the conscious beings who need those plants and ecosystems to be healthy or who derive pleasure from well-preserved artifacts. But attributing them an instrumental value can suffice to ground this duty. Since prudential well-being is at the heart of our ethical concerns, all sentient beings should enjoy the status of moral patient or moral subject. It is possible that other types of value may also generate direct duties on the part of moral agents, but I think it is for perfectionists to show this.
This definitely resonates, I think, with me. It's a hard question about where you start to draw lines and who you stand up for. And there's certainly something to be said for plants. I think there's been some incredible documentaries coming out about how mushrooms communicate and rhizomes, and there's a lot of just interesting stuff out there. But I tend to, I think, align myself with this type of thinking that there is something different. I'm not quite sure what it is. And I hope that I'm not just reinforcing a different boundary. We're approaching the end of the show now, and towards the end of the show, I always give guests an opportunity to read an excerpt or a quote. It can be something from your own work or the work of someone else who has long helped you, or something that encapsulates what you've been trying to say in this episode. Would you like to read your quote?
Yes, I'd like to quote Paola Cavalieri, whom I find very inspiring. In her book, The Animal Question, she writes, "The shift from the condition of objects to that of subjects of legal rights does not appear as a point of arrival, but rather as the initial access to the circle of possible beneficiaries of that egalitarian plateau from which contemporary political philosophy starts in order to determine any more specific individual rights." And just a little further on, which brings us to the very end of the book, she says, the normative force of the demands of the expanded theory entails a commitment not only to avoid participating in, but also to oppose present discrimination. And this because the institutional denial of fundamental rights to beings that are entitled to them does not simply deprive the victims of the objects of their rights, but is a direct attack on those very rights themselves. In other words, such a denial subverts not merely what is right, but the very idea of justice.
Wow, it's a great quote. And it's got me thinking. At the moment, I'm reading a book linked to me by Will and Sue, actually, called Philosopher and the Wolf. And he spoke a lot about some of the ideas that you've brought up here today. So everything you're saying is kind of, I'm like, yes, Brendan the Wolf has rights, or he should at least. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I digress. Since you mentioned that you've listened to some of the previous podcast episodes, thank you for that. It's exciting and new, but thank you. You know that we've been discussing quite a bit about how it's problematic for animals to be considered property, as something that you've already touched on. And it's been repeatedly observed that it's extremely difficult to effectively challenge this property status. You know, it's one thing to argue that animals should be recognized as subjects of rights, and another to know how this would happen in the real world when the vast majority do not seem ready to give up meat or renounce medication, you know, when most people are still using animals. Aren't you worried that this type of theoretical work, even if it's closer to the ideal of justice toward animals, would fail to give us any sort of practical or pragmatic guides to improving the lives of animals?
This is an excellent question. I totally get why philosophers sometimes seem to make things easy for themselves in working in an ideal theory framework, flying over the real life obstacle of a very non-ideal world, the very non-ideal world we live in. How it is helping to talk about requirements of justice if we are so far away from being able to reach them? I get the objection. I think this actually relates to why I was tempted to turn away from law and favor moral philosophy. I quickly grasp how difficult it seems to be to get the legal system to move if the citizens are not themselves ready for it. Of course, there are some famous exceptions where the legislator or the court have shown to be more progressive than the general population. The one that comes to mind is the seatbelt that people massively started wearing while driving after it became obligatory. Normally, I think we're not mistaken when we say that the law almost always falls quite a few steps behind folk or general mentalities. We have good reasons to think that even when the general population is ready for a change, it is hard to get the corresponding evolution of our laws. And on the contrary, when the law changes without people being ready for it, it is often not applied efficiently. This observation has led me to think that if we want the legal situation of non-human animals to improve significantly, we need to put a lot more efforts into changing the habits, the social norms, mm-hmm. the mentalities, the representations. Regarding the welfare of animals, polls show that most people are opposed to industrial farming, and a surprisingly high percentage of the population might even be favorable to the abolition of the meat industry, even if most people are not willing to swim against the tide and stop eating meat in their personal life as long as it is not a collective decision to do so. To me, this indicates that if we were able to obtain significant legal changes, like the prohibition to raise and kill animals for food, these particular changes would probably be respected. And if we were to collectively stop eating animals, I bet it wouldn't take much time before we would start seeing those animals in a very different light. Indeed, studies have shown that we tend to attribute much higher capacities and value to the non-humans whom we do not want to exploit for our ends. That said, I still do not see how we can get those important legal changes if we do not first succeed in forming a critical mass of citizens asking for them. Even now, with those encouraging polls, the legislator prefers to listen to the agriculture lobbyist and refuses to protect animals the way the general population would like. It takes a lot of pressure on the governments from their voters before our representatives get motivated to propose real changes. Mm. These considerations got me interested in veganism, understood as a social justice movement fighting animal exploitation. In our book on this subject, my co-author Renan Larue and I tried to demonstrate that what vegans are doing is to prepare the field for real change of order, for the replacement of the anthropocentrist, Carnist, and speciesist ideology that dominates right now by a much more pacifist and just one. In our opinion, vegans are slowly working at weakening the social and cultural pillars of the system of beliefs we all grew up in, and which makes us simply assume that that it is natural, normal, and necessary to exploit other animals for our ends. We came to think that changing the social ethos is perhaps a necessary step before hoping for truly better legal protections for non-human animals in the long run.
I think that's an excellent point. And it's rather incredible, now that I think about it, that throughout season one, we really haven't touched on veganism at all, really. We've spoken a lot about the harms that have come to animals within different industries, but not really about, you know, maybe we've skirted a bit around the edges of the tension between law and social norms. But I do think this is a rather beautiful idea that you're painting here, that in many ways, veganism and vegan ideals are trying to chart a way forward. I think it was Dinesh Wadiwal in one of his lectures that he said, I think he said something along the lines of, we are literally trying to imagine a world that doesn't yet exist. Can we imagine a world in which animals are not exploited? You said this book is coming out soon.
No, this book was came out in 2017. This was a book titled Le Véganisme in this encyclopedic collection Que sais-je, a French publisher.
Amazing. Before you go, could you perhaps tell us what you are currently working on and where people can find out more about your work?
Yes. In 2017, Renan Larue and myself published this book on veganism that I just talked about in the encyclopedic collection Que sais-je with a French publisher. Just a few weeks ago came out my second contribution to the same collection, this one entitled L'antispécisme. In this new book, I present antispecism as a form of arbitrary and unjust discrimination. I seek to identify the conditions under which speciesist discrimination exists, how it resembles and differs from other forms of discrimination, and why it is morally reprehensible. I think that the originality of my contribution is perhaps to insist in saying that speciesism, either as an ideology or in the justifications that are commonly used for discriminatory behavior, is often a form of ableism. I argue that this is the case because the motivations, or at least the main reasons offered to justify discrimination against non-human animals, are generally based on their inferior cognitive abilities. More related to the topic of this podcast, maybe, I have a chapter on abolitionism in a forthcoming book on animal ethics. In this chapter, I argue that the way we treat non-human animals today can legitimately be compared to, be considered a form of slavery. I do so, however, by stressing the importance, when drawing such parallels between different type of oppression, of doing so with sensitivity, showing genuine concern for all victims, not giving the impression that some people's suffering is simply instrumentalized to serve the interests of other beings, recognizing the uniqueness and gravity of the particular wrongs suffered by each of the vulnerable groups, and doing so in a way that serves to undermine the foundations of all the injustices involved.
Those sound incredible. Both of those contributions sound amazing. And I think I might just have to ask you to come back again to talk about them, because that's really... I mean, your second point, it's something that I've struggled with a lot. There seems to always be this tension between saying, if you're fighting for one cause, that somehow you're undermining another cause, and to like this conflation of oppression. It's really incredible work. And thank you so much for sharing with me. I know that you took a lot, you did a lot of preparation for today's episode, and it was really, it's nice to finish off season one thinking about the idea of liberty and change, and thinking that maybe we can change the law. So thank you so much for joining me today and for sharing so generously.
Thank you very much for having me, Claudia. It was a great pleasure.
V
Thank you so much to Valerie for joining me in this episode, to Jeremy John for making the logo, Gordon Clark for making the bed music, and Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. As always, if you'd like to connect with me, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Claudia F. Town. That's Claudia F. and T-O-W-N-E. Our next episode will be the last of the season. Woohoo! I speak to two graduate students like myself who also have an interest in animals and the law. And together we unpack what we have learned in season one. What are some of the interesting connections and ideas to emerge across the episodes? What are some of the things that are missing? What questions do we still have? Join us to find out. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Huttenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.